All right, we are in 2 Kings chapter 9 is where we're going to start today. We left off last week with Elisha and his prophecy of the death of Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, the rise of his successor. Okay, and then that leads us at the end of chapter 8, you have something that we've already looked at in our study of the kings. That was the reign of Ahaziah. Ahaziah was a one-year wonder. He reigned 1 year in Judah. And we're going to see how that ties back in with the timeline here. All right. So the last two things that are mentioned about the miracles or the major points of the ministry of Elisha was that he anointed Jehu in 2 Kings 9. And then his final miracle was after his own death, actually. And we'll talk about that later on down the line. All right. So I got a duplicate slide there. Now, that brings us back to 2 Kings chapter 9 and the divided kingdom. All right, so this is a brief overview. The left-hand column, from your perspective, the left-hand column is Judah. The right-hand column is Israel. So Rehoboam was the son of Solomon. And then you had Abijam, and then Asa, and Jehoshaphat. You notice 17, 41, 25, there were some long reigns there as king. Well, on the other side, after Jeroboam, 2, 24, 2, 1 week, 12, 22, 2, 12. That's a lot shorter times on the right-hand side. That would be the kings of Israel. And we've covered all of these earlier in our study. Okay, so picking up with Ahab and Jehoshaphat. I carried those over just for the continuity, but you have Ahab and Jehoshaphat there. That brings us down here to the time that we're looking at now in 2 Kings chapter 9. The fun thing about trying to keep up with names, you have an Ahaziah over here on the right-hand side, which would be the northern kingdom, and you have an Ahaziah over here on the left-hand side, which is the southern kingdom, okay? Just like you had Jehoram and Jehoram. One of them went by Jehoram, one of them went by Joram. Okay, but anyway, that where we're looking at today is going to be Jehu, all right? So all of this timeline converges with Jehu. As we've come down, you actually had Jehoram and Jehoram overlapping at the same time, one in the south, one in the north, lots of fun. And Ahaziah was the one in the south that was mentioned here at the end of chapter 8, okay? So, you have Ahaziah in the south, who is allied with the north. You have Jehoram in the north, and they had gone to battle together, all right? If you look with me, if we back up from chapter 9, just to the very end of chapter 8, verse number 27, he walked in the way of the house of Ahab, and did evil in the sight of the Lord, as did the house of Ahab, for he was the son-in-law of the house of Ahab. So Ahaziah, on the left, which is the line of Judah, was son-in-law to the house of Ahab, so he was intermarried with the north. Which is why, verse 28, he went with Joram, son of Ahab, to the war against Hazael. That was his brother-in-law or extended family by marriage. Against Hazael, king of Syria. Now, if you look back up in verses 7 through 15 of chapter 8, this is the guy that Elisha had prophesied would be the next king of Syria. Okay? So Hazael is king over Syria. He's fighting against Israel. Verse 28, it says, they were fighting in Ramoth-Gilead, and the Syrians wounded Joram. All right? Verse 29, King Joram went back to be healed in Jezreel of the wounds which Assyrians had given him at Ramah, when he fought against Hazael, king of Syria. And Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, went down to see Joram because he was sick. Okay, so Ahaziah in the south has gone to visit Joram of the north. They were fighting together, and he was wounded at Ramoth-Gilead. It seems like, based on what we see in chapter 9, that Israel had succeeded in either capturing it or defending it, because in chapter 9, they were holding Ramoth-Gilead. Okay, but that brings us then to Jehu. Chapter 9, verse 1, Elisha the prophet called one of the children of the prophets and said unto him, gird up thy loins and take this box of oil in thine hand and go to Ramoth-Gilead. When thou comest thither, look out there Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi. Okay, so there are two Jehus. No, I didn't say two Yehus. Okay, there are two Jehus that are mentioned here in 1 and 2 Kings. One of them is a prophet who spoke for the Lord and either advised kings, rebuked kings. This Jehu was a general in the army who would eventually become king over Israel. Okay? So all we're told about him is that he was the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi. And that's it. We don't know his tribe, you know, his affiliations. We don't know much of that. All right? Verse number 2 again. When thou comest thither, look out there Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, son of Nimshi. Go in and make him arise from among his brethren and carry him into an inner chamber. Then take a box of oil and pour it on his head and say, thus saith the Lord, I have anointed thee king over Israel. Then open the door and flee and tarry not. So the young man, even the young man, the prophet, went to Ramoth-Gilead. Now, this is kind of a big deal. Okay? He's anointing a king, but Elisha didn't go do it himself. Okay? I mean, if you think about it, in our terms today, maybe pastor tells Pastor Stephen, all right, you take care of this responsibility. Or maybe he takes the intern and says, hey, I want you to handle this responsibility. I mean, this was a big deal to anoint somebody to be a king, right? But Elisha sent one of the sons of the prophets to do this. So, we don't know much of his lineage. We know nothing of his upbringing. Really, the only thing about his history prior to this that we know is found a little bit later on. Look down in chapter 9 and verse number 25. Chapter 9, verse 25. Then said Jehu to Bidkar his captain, take up and cast him in the portion of the field of Naboth the Jezreelite. For remember how that when I and thou rode together after Ahab his father, the Lord laid this burden upon him. All right, so what we see there is that he was a general or at least a leader in the army under Ahab. Okay? So Jehu was a soldier under the time of Ahab. And at this point in time, he seems to be one of the leaders, if not the leader of the army of Israel. Okay? But other than that, we don't know much about his background or his upbringing. All right? So chapter 10, verse 36 tells us that he reigned 28 years. But based on, you know, the little clues that we have, he was most likely the general. Now, some of you may be familiar with the Jewish historian Josephus, not personally, but you've heard the name, okay? But Josephus was a Jewish man in the 1st, 2nd century AD, wrote extensively, and because he was closer to the events, you know, his record has been taken and held in high regard very often, okay? Josephus says Jehu was likely the most able general of the army who was promoted to the head of the army. If you remember, at the end of chapter 8, King Joram was wounded at Ramoth-Gilead. Where was Jehu and his army in chapter 9? The end of verse 1, he said, take this box of oil and go to what? Ramoth-Gilead. Okay, so Jehu was there defending, you know, the site of the last battle while the king had gone home for medical care and recuperation. Okay? So, that at this point, that's what it seems like. It seems like Jehu had risen to the point of a general, and Josephus says he was likely promoted to the head of the army at this point, at being recognized as the most capable, most successful general. Verse 4, the young men, even the young man the prophet, went to Ramoth-Gilead. And when he came, behold, the captains of the host were sitting. And he said, I have an errand unto thee, O captain. And Jehu said unto which of us? And he said, to thee, O captain. And he arose and went into the house. All right? You see that it says he went into the house? That's why I think they were occupying Ramoth-Gilead. They were in the city. It doesn't say he went into his tent as though they were, you know, outside and fighting against the king of Syria. Looks like they were inside the city and defending against a potential return from Syria, okay? Verse 6, he went into the house, and he poured the oil on his head and said unto him, Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I have anointed thee king over the people of the Lord, even over Israel. And thou shalt smite the house of Ahab thy master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all the servants of the Lord at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off from Ahab him that pisseth against the wall, and him that is shut up and left in Israel. And I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha the son of Ahijah. And the dogs shall eat Jezebel and the portion of Jezreel, and there shall be none to bury her. And he opened the door and fled. I mean, this would be simultaneously a super exciting assignment and a super scary assignment. Because Joram is still the king. While the king was in power, he is anointing someone else to take his place and execute him and his household. What if Joram finds out about this? Exactly, he's dead. This is, he would be considered treason. He said, look, you're going to take care of the house of Ahab. You're going to take care of Jezebel for her wickedness. And then he got out of there as fast as he could. Okay, so you have a little bit of background here. Jehu was ahead of the army at the time he was anointed to destroy Joram. Okay, so what you see in the next few verses, verse 11, when Jehu came forth to the servants of his Lord, one said unto him, Is all well? Wherefore came this mad fellow to thee? Now maybe that's what they really thought, or maybe they were fishing for information, right? I know you've never done that. You know, played dumb and just asked questions to see what somebody would tell you. And he said, You know the man in his communication. He said, Come on, you know why he was here. Verse 12, and they said, It is false. Tell us now. Nope, you're wrong. I don't have any idea what you're talking about. Verse 12, and he said, It is false. Tell us now. And he said, Thus and thus spake he unto me, saying, Thus saith the Lord, I have anointed thee king over Israel. Then they hasted and took every man his garment and put it under him on the top of the stairs and blew with trumpets, saying, Jehu is king. So Jehu had to have respect because he was with the captains. Remember when the young man showed up? He said, I have a message for you, O captain. And he said, Which of all of us? In other words, there were several generals and officials there. And he said, To you, O captain, meaning the highest ranking one, which would be Jehu. But, I mean, this is the military there. If their loyalty was to Joram, I mean, they're now going to execute Jehu, right? So Jehu's kind of taking a step here to say, Hey, he anointed me king over Israel. The army immediately falls in line behind Jehu. They put their garments down, they blow the trumpets, they give him the royal treatment. So they immediately are behind him, but it wasn't like, okay, let's go. There was some planning involved here. So you see here, I've already mentioned these things, but Joram was wounded in a battle for Ramoth-Gilead. Jehu was there occupying Ramoth-Gilead at the time that he was anointed. So there at Ramoth-Gilead is where Jehu was anointed. That's where they came up with the plan. Where was Joram, the king? Where had he gone to heal? You go back to the end of chapter 8. He was gone back to Jezreel. Okay, so he hadn't gone back to the capital city of Samaria. He had gone to Jezreel. He probably had a summer house there or a vacation house. Maybe there was, you know, natural springs or something else like that that made it a better spot, maybe better medical care. I don't know, but he'd gone back to Jezreel. So, Jehu here is anointed king while he was at Ramoth-Gilead. Verse 14, Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, conspired against Joram. Now, Joram had kept Ramoth-Gilead, he and all Israel, because of Hazael, king of Syria. So, his assignment has been Ramoth-Gilead. They were there on the northern flank defending against a return attack from Syria. 15, verse 15, but King Joram was returned to be healed in Jezreel of the wounds which the Syrians had given him when he fought with Hazael, king of Syria. And Jehu said, If it be your minds, then let none go forth nor escape out of the city to go tell it in Jezreel. He's like, all right, if we're going to do this, nobody says a word. Nobody leaves. They had COVID lockdowns. I mean, you know, he locked down the city so that the word didn't get out. So then what we see in the rest of the chapter here is that he actually, whatever time was spent in planning and preparations, when he went to Jezreel, he ended up killing Joram and Ahaziah on the same day. Now, if you go back to the end of chapter 8, you see that Ahaziah had gone to visit him. It seems like Ahaziah had gone home, and he heard that he was improving, he was recuperating, so he went to visit him. So Joram and Ahaziah are in the same spot. Verse number 16, so Jehu rode in a chariot and went to Jezreel, for Joram lay there, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, was come down to see Joram. Verse 17, there stood a watchman on the tower in Jezreel. Now this is the part, if you know anything about Jehu, that you're probably familiar with. Okay, what's the most familiar characteristic about Jehu? Yeah, he liked fast horses. He was a furious driver. Okay, so that either means road rage or it means racing. I think it means speed, not anger. Okay, furious. But, that's the thing which Jehu's best known for, probably, is his driving. But in the context, Jehu has been anointed king. He's trying to keep this quiet. He was the general. So for the general to come and report to the king, you know, may or may not have been, you know, unusual. But the watchman spotted him. Verse 17, there stood a watchman on the tower in Jezreel. He spied the company of Jehu as he came, and he said, I see a company. So Jehu didn't come by himself. He came with a crowd. He came with soldiers. And Joram said, take a horseman and send to meet them, and let him say, is it peace? So it was far enough out he could see a crowd coming, but not close enough that he could tell who it was. And so they sent a rider on horseback to go meet him. Verse 18, there went one on horseback to meet him and said, thus saith the king, is it peace? And Jehu said, what hast thou to do with peace? Turn thee behind me. Now, I mean, just for argument's sake, let's just say that Brother Jim here is the messenger that was sent. He rides out there to meet Jehu and said, the king wants to know if you're come peaceably. And he said, peace? I got nothing to do with peace. Get in line behind me. He's like, I'm going to go tell the king that this is trouble. What's going to happen to Jim? Yeah, he's not making it back, right? So in an effort of self-preservation, Jim just obediently falls in line with the procession of Jehu. Okay? Middle of verse 18, turn thee behind me. And the watchman told, saying, the messenger came to them, but he cometh not again. Verse 19, then he sent out a second on horseback, which came to them and said, thus saith the king, is it peace? And Jehu answered, what hast thou to do with peace? Turn thee behind me. All right, so this time we rise up the ranks of the dignitaries and we send John Phillips. So he says, come on, what's your purpose here? And he says, peace? I don't want to hear about peace. You want to save your life? Get in line, be quiet. So the second messenger gets in line as well. Verse number 20, the watchman told, saying, he came even unto them and cometh not again. And the driving is like the driving of Jehu the son of Nimshi, for he driveth furiously. That's why I was saying, I don't think furious means anger there. It means speed, intensity, recklessly, wild. Okay? So, verse 21, Joram said, make ready. And his chariot was made ready. And Joram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, went out, each in his chariot. Now, earlier in the chapter, it said he lay at Jezreel. Well, now it sounds like he's well enough to get in the chariot and ride out and meet him. So maybe he's just summoning strength to go deal with this, or maybe, just maybe, he was milking this injury so he didn't have to go back to the battlefield. You know, we don't know for sure, but he was well enough to ride on this day, and as it turns out, it was his last ride. But verse 21 again, make ready. And Joram the king of Israel and Ahaziah king of Judah went out, each in his chariot. And they went out against Jehu and met him in the portion of Naboth the Jezreelite. Does that sound familiar? Jezreel. Naboth the Jezreelite was from Jezreel. Ahab had a summer house there. He wanted Naboth's vineyard. Naboth didn't want to sell it to him. So Jezebel had him tried, had hired people to lie about him, had him executed. Okay, so right there on the edge of the city is where they met up. Verse 22, came to pass when Joram saw Jehu that he said, is it peace, Jehu? Why do you think he kept asking this question. Think he had an idea? He already knew the answer? Yeah. Everything okay? Everything okay? Everything okay? He had this nagging feeling that it wasn't. All right? Verse number 22. Came to pass when Joram saw Jehu, he said, "Is it peace, Jehu?" And he answered, "What peace? So long as the whoredoms of thy mother Jezebel and her witchcrafts are so many." Well, that's an interesting way to phrase it. There's no peace in the land as long as the spiritual whore, your mother Jezebel, is allowed to do her thing. That doesn't sound like, "Hello, King, good to see you. I've got good news for you." That doesn't sound like anything positive at all, does it? That sounds like an insult and an attack. I mean, that was not the proper decorum to speak to the king, was it? I mean, this was a breach of protocol. And so for him to speak this way, he is obviously asserting equality or superiority. He is not following the protocol at all. And this was his statement of, "I'm here to bring judgment on your household." Verse 23, Joram turned his hands and fled and said to Ahaziah, "There is treachery, O Ahaziah." Yeah, I'd say so. Verse 24, Jehu drew a bow with his full strength. Now, just a side note here. I don't know how many of you have ever messed, you know, with a bow and arrow. But if you just assume that it's a wooden type bow that, as far as we know, didn't have plastic composites at that time. You know, the longer the bow, the more pull you could get, you know, and the more flex you had in it. I've never seen any pictures or evidence that they had what we would call today compound bows. All right, a compound bow is one that has pulleys on the top and bottom. And basically it multiplies your effort, so you pull it the same amount and it puts more force on that arrow when it's released by the string. But it says he drew it at full strength. Okay, apparently Jehu was a strong man. He drew it at full strength. So I'm envisioning, you know, a bow that's probably 4, 5, 6 feet tall. He's bending it just as hard as he can. Verse 24, he drew a bow with his full strength and smote Jehoram between his arms, and the arrow went out at his heart, and he sunk down in the chariot. So it sounds like he turned around to run, and he's like, "All right, fine," and he shot him in the back because it said it came out at his heart. It looks like it went in the back, and he's sticking out the front, went right through his heart. Okay, and this was not a cartoon thing, you know, with a little clip to make it look like that. This was the real deal. Now, I don't know if you've ever messed with a bow and arrow, or your kids have, or whatever, but, you know, to have, there was no, you know, razor blade tips for arrows at this point in time. I mean, they may well have had metal tips and that kind of thing, but the kind of thing that we would think about as, you know, razor blade tips that are four ways and expand on impact and that kind of thing, they didn't have that. You know, they didn't have aluminum tubes to make the arrows lighter. So the kind of force that would take a wooden arrow with whatever stone or metal tip they had and put it through somebody, that also means it had to hit in between the ribs. If it had hit the bone, it would have probably stuck in the bone, but it kind of went in between the bones, in between the rib cage or whatever. That's a lot of force on what we would call a low-tech arrow. Okay? So, Jehu executes Joram, verse 25. Then said Jehu to Bidkar, his captain, "Take up and cast him in the portion of the field of Naboth the Jezreelite. For remember how that when I and thou rode together after Ahab his father, the Lord laid this burden upon him." All right, so now that we had read earlier in the context of his previous service under Ahab, but we also see that here he was aware of the prophecy that God had made about Ahab and his rebellion. God, when Ahab stole the field from Naboth, it was prophesied at that time, "You're going to die right here." He said, "Throw his body in the vineyard, in the field of Naboth." Verse 26, "Surely I've seen yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his son, saith the Lord. And I will requite thee in this plot, saith the Lord. Now therefore take and cast him in the plot of ground according to the word of the Lord." Verse 27. But when Ahaziah, the king of Judah, saw this, he fled by the way of the garden house. And Jehu followed after him and said, smite him also in the chariot. And they did so at the going up to Gur, which is by Ibleam. So he made it a little ways out of town, and he fled to Megiddo and died there. And his servants carried him in a chariot to Jerusalem and buried him in his sepulcher with his fathers in the city of David. In the 11th year of Joram, the son of Ahab, began Azariah to reign over Judah. So if you remember, I'm sure you don't, but if you were to go back and look at the chart that I put up to start with, Ahaziah was 1 year, Joram was 12 years. So the last year, the two of them overlapped. But in the same day, Jehu executed the king of Israel and the king of Judah. Remember, the king of Judah at this point was related by marriage to the house of Ahab. So really, this was a continuation of the judgment of God on the house of Ahab. Ahaziah had followed the sins of the house of Ahab and the idolatry of Baal in the south because of his affiliation with them. So here, in one day, both of them were killed in the judgment of God. So, did Ahab and Jezebel get away with it, all of their idolatry? Nope. Did God deal with it as fast as we would have wanted him to? Were we alive at that time? Nope. Because Ahab reigned 22 years, and then Ahaziah 2, and then Joram 12. So this is happening 14 years after the death of Ahab, if my timeline is correct. Okay? But if I've missed something, it's still close. 14, 15, 16 years along in there. Okay? So Ahab lived 22 years. He died. Jezebel was still living at this point. Okay? But Jehu had served under Ahab. All right? So now he has served under Joram. He is well aware of Jezebel, and she knows who he is. Okay? But in one day, God brings all of this together. Verse number 30. The next thing that happened is the execution of Jezebel. When Jehu was come to Jezreel. So remember, they had met in the field outside the portion of Naboth. Now he's coming into the city. When Jezebel heard of it, she painted her face and tired her head and looked out at a window. Now the literalist in me says tired her head. I wonder if that was Goodyear or Cooper or Yokohama. I think if you put an A-T on the front of that word, you come up with the word attire. I think that's probably a closer understanding of what that old word is. You know, she fixed her hair, she put on her ornaments or, you know, whatever, scarf, attire, she dressed herself up. So she painted her face and tired her head and looked out at a window. Verse 31, as Jehu entered in at the gate, she said, so she's waiting, she's watching out the window, and when Jehu comes in, she's yelling down to him. Verse 31 in the middle, she said, had Zimri peace, who slew his master? So apparently the word's gotten back to her already, and she said, hey, you remember this other guy that tried to commit rebellion? It didn't work out so well for him. Verse 32, he lifted up his face to the window and said, who's on my side? Who? Now remember, Jehu is not unknown to these people, okay? He has served under Ahab. He has served under Joram. He is a general in the army. He's been in and out of this city many times. These people know him, okay? So this isn't just like a total stranger. They know who he is. But also understand, these are people who had to work for Jezebel. The people that we're getting ready to talk about were employees of Jezebel. Do you think that that was an ideal position? You think they had more applicants than they had positions to be household servants for Jezebel? Yeah, I don't think so. I think this was a forced slavery type position, okay? And Jezebel would have been a tyrant, a miserable person to work for based on everything that we see and know about her character, okay? So there were people that had to put up with her because she was the wife of the king or, you know, after the death of Ahab, the mother-in-law of the king or the mother of the king. But that doesn't mean they liked her. So he said, who's on my side? Who? Middle of verse 32. There looked down to him two or three eunuchs. Okay? A eunuch typically means forced sterilization. And that's what they would do with the servants then that would work in the house of the women. Okay? They would sterilize them, and then, you know, to minimize the possibility of problems, and then they would work in the house of the women. So these were household servants in the house of Jezebel. All right? Verse 33, and he said, throw her down. You got to use your imagination right here. I mean, it's like, really? I don't know. I mean, I think they were, who's on my side? Right here. I'm your man. Throw her down. Yes, sir. All right, you get that side. Here we go. Okay? They were fed up with Jezebel. Okay? It didn't take a lot of convincing for these guys to get rid of her. So she was in an upper window, and they threw her down. And some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall and on the horses. So it seems like where she fell was pretty close to where his chariot procession had stopped. You know, he stopped underneath, and he's looking up at her. So he had a front row seat for this deal. Okay? Throw her down. So there was a big impact splatter. It was on his chariot. Now the end of verse 34, and he trode her underfoot. He took his chariot and he drove it over her carcass, stomped her with the horses, and rode the chariot wheels over the top of it. Okay? Guarantee you, whatever side they were on politically, there were a lot of people that were cheering this move right here. I mean, Jezebel had it coming, if anybody ever did, just from a personality standpoint, right? Okay, I'm not going to ask for modern-day comparisons. Okay, I don't want anybody mentioning any politicians with the initials of HC because we don't want to, you know, sidetrack this discussion. But, you know, there are people that just, you know, have it coming, and you don't always see it in life. They finally got to see, to use a good Southern expression, they got to see Jezebel get her comeuppance. Okay? In other words, she reaped what she had sown. Verse 34, when he was come in, he did eat and drink. And then he said, go see now this cursed woman. He drove over her, went inside, and said, I'm hungry, let's eat. I mean, some of you are already giving me the look, and we're just, you know, trying to describe this. You know, remember, he's a general in the army. He has seen this stuff, and, you know, he was more hardened to it than we would be. Maybe Joram didn't have a good heart. His was punctured, according to what we're told, but I don't know if he was being kind about it or he's just like, okay, I guess this would be the right protocol, but he said, he went in to eat and drink, and he said, go see now this cursed woman and bury her, for she is a king's daughter. He's like, well, as much as I don't like her, I guess we should do the right thing and bury her. Verse 35, and when they went to bury her, but they found no more of her than the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. The dogs, the wild dogs, the jackals, whatever, they had gotten a hold of, they had eaten everything. Okay? God had prophesied of Jezebel that she would not have an honorable burial. Okay? And said, your carcass is going to be as dung on the face of the earth. Well, what happened? After the animals ate her, and their bodies processed what they had eaten, what did she end up being? Waste on the face of the earth. Okay? All that was left was the skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. I can't take credit for this, but, you know, one of my students told me a few years ago the reason, you know why they didn't eat her hands? And I said, no. And he said, apparently didn't like finger food. I don't know. I think it says the palms of her hands, so maybe it was this part. Maybe they did bite off the fingers. I don't know. But nonetheless, there was no corpse to bury, and you're only talking about a couple of hours. All right? Verse 36, wherefore they came again and told him, and he said, this is the word of the Lord which he spake by his servant Elijah the Tishbite, saying, in the portion of Jezreel shall dogs eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the carcass of Jezebel shall be as dung on the face of the field in the portion of Jezreel, so that they shall not say, this is Jezebel. There wasn't a carcass to bury. Now, we're probably thinking, okay, yeah, well, Jezebel got what she deserved. But I mean, if you think about this on the flip side, if this were someone that you thought well of or respected, I mean, that would be an awful disgrace to someone to not even, you know, be able to give them a proper burial or funeral or whatever. Now, Jezebel, outside of her own household, probably didn't have too many sympathizers other than her household and the people she paid to be prophets of Baal. But nonetheless, this is a terrible disgrace. But it seems like, I don't know for sure if this happened on the same day or if it happened, you know, the next day. It's very possible all of this happened on the same day. He meets, because the portion of Naboth was near Jezreel. I mean, it would have been within a day's journey of that on foot, I think. So, I mean, it's very possible that all of these things happened in the same day. I mean, if it wasn't the same day, it was very soon, the next day or whatever. But you had Joram, Ahaziah, and Jezebel all killed the same day or, you know, in very close proximity. The Joram and Ahaziah were shot the same day. But this is the judgment of God on the house of Ahab. It says here that Elijah the Tishbite is the one who had prophesied this years ago. Now, at this point in time, Elisha is the prophet of record. Elijah's been off the scene a while. But what does that tell us? God doesn't forget. God keeps his word. Promises that we would call them positively or negatively. You know, God does keep those things, right? So, then that brings us to chapter 10. And he continues the judgment on the house of Ahab. I think we'll call it good for today right there. So we won't have time to finish all of that. But Jehu had the privilege to do what other people wanted to do, right? To get rid of the house of Ahab and Jezebel. And God is the one that sent the prophet, told Elisha to send somebody. And God, through the messenger, said, you're going to wipe out the house of Ahab. When God uses someone like that, what is their responsibility? I mean, their responsibility is to respond appropriately to how God's blessed them and used them, right? What we're going to see with Jehu is he did not. In chapter 10, if you go ahead and read ahead on that, you'll see that he got rid of the idols of Baal and he, you know, destroyed the worship of Baal, but he didn't fully follow the Lord. Okay, why am I saying that? Because, you know, our responsibility is not just to, you know, enjoy the blessings, but also to be faithful in our service. I mean, the holiday season is a time when we reflect on the Lord's blessings and think about the good things, but even if we just start with salvation, what is the right response to our salvation and the Lord's taking care of us? To serve him to the best of our ability, right? Jehu didn't do that, but we have the opportunity to do it right. Let's pray. Thank you, Lord.